grant me the serenity to accept the things I can change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Please respect our speaker and silence your cell phones. Our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. And I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Tom from San Clemente.
Thank you. Greetings. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I drank because I like the effect.
Yeah.
I loved the effect of alcohol. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And I drank some more. And I drank until I couldn't drink anymore. And then I drank for another 10 years. That's how it went. What a great honor to be able to speak in front of you tonight. What a great room, huh? A lot of men and women have spoken in this room. In our book, it talks about when we share, we talk about what happened, or you know, what it was like, what happened, and you know, what it's like now. So, I'll start from my childhood. I grew up in La Habra in the hills. My parents built a home there in the 50s. And there was avocado groves and orange groves and lemon groves. And I did a lot of wandering around as a kid, building forts and tree forts and underground forts and, you know, played army and orange fights, lemon fights, you know, all it was a really, I think it was a great childhood. My children never got to experience anything like that. But my mother was, came from an alcoholic family. Her stepfather used to beat her. He used to get pissed off and take his .45 and shoot holes in the floor. He used to put her in razor wire when he got mad at her. I'm talking about a 5-6-year-old kid. Put it, you know, don't move. My father, at the age of 12, witnessed the death of his father, got hit by a train. And as a consequence, he emotionally shut down totally. Completely emotionally unavailable. Because he blamed himself. My mother was a prescription addict, and all these things I learned after getting sober. I didn't know any of this prior to getting sober. Because she was taking something called Miltown, which was meprobamate, which was a form of Valium, a little bit stronger. I know from personal experience, I got to try them out later in life. So both my parents were emotionally unavailable, and what I learned in ACA, which is Adult Children of Alcoholics, which was an offshoot of the Al-Anon program, was that when your parents are emotionally unavailable, it has an effect on you, whether you like it or not. And the effect that it had on me is that I didn't know what an authentic emotional connection was to another human being at a young age. It just didn't exist. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't realize that my overuse of my imagination was to keep myself connected somehow. I guess the only connection I really had was with my brother, who was 15 years older. He left when I was pretty young. He got married at 18. And so I was pretty little. And when he left, you know, it was like the only person I ever had a real connection with left. So my mother indulged me, and I think she overindulged me. She would buy me anything I wanted. She would tell people how smart I was. She would just go overboard when she introduced me and, you know, how smart and wonderful and great. And you know, in one sense, you'd think, oh, that's really cool that a parent would be, you know, that encouraging, but it was kind of over the top, and it created for me maybe an expectation that I couldn't live up to. or a pressure that I really didn't want to accept about living up to those expectations. My father, on the other hand, was an engineer. He was a brilliant guy. He had an appointment to Annapolis he didn't take. He was responsible for designing some technologically first things, like putting a 90 degree bend in titanium and made it strong in the 40s. That was critical to aircraft and then later rocket technology and so forth, and he invented the process to make that possible. And he worked for NASA, and he was just a brilliant guy, but you know, he was very non-emotional, and I would always try to avoid him, because when he saw me, you know, it was usually work. You know, we lived on a third of an acre, and it was all landscaped. Everything was landscaped. It had, you know, split leaf philodendron. It had, you know, a dichondra lawn that I had to pick the weeds out of. I mean, it was crazy. So I always tried to avoid him, because one, he never was very nice in terms of, you know, I love you, or, you know, how you doing today? You know, let's go throw some catch. You know, none of that happened, right? It was just, you know, kind of an avoidance thing, because if he ever saw me, he was like, what are you doing right now? Why don't you go out there and rake the leaves or something? I was like, oh, jeez. So what does this all mean, and how does it relate to my behavior as it relates to my alcoholism? Well, I believe as a result of that environment and growing up in it, I developed a very deep-seated insecurity about myself. And in order to compensate for that deep, deep-seated insecurity about myself, I used my ego to compensate. And that theme is kind of carried on forward through my whole drinking career and everything, that I was always scared to death, but had a huge ego to try to compensate for it. And you might say, well, Tom, how did you know that you were insecure? Well, let me give you just a couple of examples. I remember in elementary school, I went to El Cerrito, elementary school there in La Habra, and it was probably 7 or 8, and my dad in his side drawer always kept the Playboy magazines in his bedroom, which I discovered one time. Pretty fascinating. And as I'm going through the magazine, there's a picture of a 1969 Dodge Charger RT with the big fin on the back. And I just thought that was the greatest thing ever. So I took that advertisement out of the Playboy, and I folded it up, put it in my pocket, and at the bus stop, I was there with my buddies, and I pulled that thing out, and I opened it up, and I showed it to them, and I said, my dad just bought this car. And they all went, wow, awesome. And I could see my dad driving me to school or pulling up in front of all of us with that thing with the wing and the whole deal, and me jumping in it and driving off, and, you know. So I was already delusional. But for that split second, I felt connected. I felt like I did when I had that drink. These guys liked me. I felt they were like, yeah, that's awesome. You're cool. You're, you know, I felt like I belonged. And I craved that. I craved the acknowledgement. I craved the connection. So I would do and say things that were not true in order to get that kind of recognition, and because I was deeply insecure, so I was compensating for it. And as a result, I created this persona. And this persona was malleable. It would change and morph depending on who I was with. Okay? I mean, if I was with some tough guys, all of a sudden it would morph into kind of a tough guy. If I was with some nerds who like chess, then I became kind of chess-like, you know? Because I knew how to play chess. I could talk the talk. You know, I was smart enough that I just could talk a little bit of just about everything. So I was this chameleon. And unfortunately, some of the more, quote, authentic people in schools as I was growing up could see through that. And they didn't really want to associate. They could see through the bullshit. But of course, being so afraid and creating this persona, I had so identified with it that I was so self-absorbed and selfish and self-seeking as it related to that, I couldn't hear or see when they saw through me. You know, it just wasn't there. It didn't exist. So I just went about my business and did the same thing. So I get into high school, and I go to like one of my first real parties where there's, you know, alcohol. And well, before that, it was sixth grade. I had some Strawberry Hill, and I had like maybe, I don't know, one or two drinks, and I faked passing out so I could impress all my friends. Because, see, also part of this persona that I had is I like to be the rebel. I like to be the outlaw, the desperado, you know. This is how I identify. So the guy in sixth grade who drinks, gets so drunk and passes out, where his friends have to pick him up and drag him around, is going to have some good stories. Or they're going to have some good stories to tell about me, right? Me! Because that's what's driving me. So it was a false alarm, false start on the alcohol trail. But it still had some payoff for me. But anyway, get into high school, we go drinking, some guy pulls out a marijuana cigarette, and, you know, I'm pretty nervous about all that. Because, you know, also in sixth grade, the cops had come in and they'd had these little incense things. If you smell this, you got to get out of the room because, you know, you're gonna jump out a window or something, you know. Scared the hell out of you. So I was pretty nervous about experimenting with anything other than alcohol at that point. But when I finally got a buzz on, I was like, holy smokes, this is great. Yeah, get down. I like this feeling. I'm, you know, that emptiness that I felt, that fear, you know, that insecurity was kind of, you know, pushed down, pushed away. It just didn't come up for me. So now I'm highly motivated. I love this feeling. And I got my first, well, my first job was with at the Sizzler. I was a busboy. And I did a pretty good job there. I didn't do anything too rash. But my next job was at a Chinese place called the Royal Peacock. And I got all my buddies in there. And this is after we started drinking. And we would just steal these people blind. Because we would walk into the walk-in cooler and we would just grab whatever was there. You know, like cold duck was big. And we would just guzzle it down, throw it in the trash. Just for the heck of it, I don't know why we did this, but we would take the glassware when we got buzzed and we'd walk out the back door and we'd zip it, you know, in the parking lot and watch it explode. I mean, I can't imagine the thousands of dollars of glassware that we completely obliterated. I, you know, there was something about drinking and getting a little bit violent with things, not necessarily with people, but damaging things. I you know, it was just kind of came with the territory at that time, at that point in my life. And then I remember one time I was there that my buddies, I was the dishwasher, and, you know, it gets really super hot, and I'm washing the dishes, and one of my buddies comes in with a pitcher full of ice water, throws it on me, and we're all drunk at this point, throws it on me, and I scream. Well, the whole restaurant just went dead silent. And people started to get up to leave because it was just so, you know, earth-shattering. But for some reason, they didn't fire me. They didn't fire me until I knocked a hole in the wall back there that you could drive a truck through in the kitchen. And why did I do it? Because I thought there was a secret treasure in the wall. I don't know. That's what I said. So so in high school, I really enjoyed drinking. I didn't go to a lot of classes. As a senior, I would take some of the girls, and I could buy beer at a local liquor store, and we would go drink, and I'd come back to school drunk. I thought that was cool. And as soon as I turned 18, they said, "You're out of here." So they kicked me out of high school. My parents said, "Well, you're kicked out of high school, so you got to go get a job." So I went to Builders Emporium, which was a Lowe's, Home Depot, but much on a much smaller scale, but had all the departments. So I was a proud Builders Beaver. And I had my little beaver on my shirt, and it was awesome. And, you know, anything I did, I usually did all the way. That's the kind of guy I am. You know, if I get into something, I'm like totally all the way in. It's like not a little bit, it's all in all the time. And so I got pretty good. They liked me. They, you know, they gave me some promotions, and I was running my little department. And I worked in plumbing. I worked in automotive, you know. And I started to learn a lot, and I used to be able to help people. And then I started working nights. My parents at that point moved from La Habra to Newport Beach. They bought a place across from the cannery there on Lido Peninsula, but I stayed in La Habra. Don't ask me why. Because I was living with a friend, and I was, you know, out of the house. Okay, so I had my own place, which was pretty cool. And what I would do on a regular basis is I would go to this place called the Bagel Shop, and they had these giant 33-ounce cups. And then I would go to Ralph's next door, and I'd buy these 32-ounce beers. Because they saw it. Somehow they thought I was older. I don't know what the deal was. But anyway, I did it. And I would fill the cups up with the beer. So I would literally, at night, now imagine you guys walking into Lowe's or to Home Depot, right? And the guy that's there to help you walks up with a full 32-ounce beer, right, in the uniform, and says, "Yeah, can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah, I need this plumbing part or this or that." And I would literally take them, and I'm just, you know, buzzed, I had the thing going, and sometimes I'd say, "Could you hold this?" And I'd be down, you know, getting what they needed or whatever. I didn't care. And I did that every night. Never got fired. So the next day, the manager called me and said, "We got some complaints from customers saying that you were," and he goes, because he saw me in a certain way. And he said, "This is going to stretch. I know we have this issue with the cashiers." So the cashiers were a different union than the union I was in. And there were some adversarial feelings going on. So whatever. So he says, "The cashier's got a complaint that you were drinking on the floor with this thing." I was like, "What?" I said, "Yeah." And see, he goes, "I thought that was pretty silly." I go, "Oh my God." And I can't, you know. And that was it. It was like, whatever. So one night, and I still didn't get fired, right? Because I just... Then one night, I come in there, I drink a little bit too much, and I go to the back in the warehouse, and then the warehouse construction was all wood, and they had this big axe, double-headed axe, and I'm like, "God, this is cool." So, I don't know why, but I started chopping down the inventory, you know, the shelving. And it just felt so good. You know, I'd swing that thing, and it would hit the post, and, you know, it would go in about 4 or 5 inches, and I'd hit it again, and a big piece would fly off, and I'd hit it again, and I don't know. I had some rage issues or something. But I was drunk, and it felt good. And I came in the next day, and the guy pulls me in the office and says, "What's going on? Why did you chop down the, you know, the inventory?" I said, "I don't know. I made something up. I don't know. Somebody died or something." And he's like, "Okay." He still didn't fire me. So then he says, "I want you to go to the warehouse next door, and I want you to move all these glass shelvings for us." I'm like, "Okay." He goes, I'm letting you think about what you did over here. You know, this wasn't cool. I'm like, okay. So I'm back there, and this is like these big 8-foot pieces of glass. And I thought, you know what? Man, this all. So I just give it up. And those things, man, they would explode when they hit the concrete floor. And then there was huge stacks of those fluorescent lights, and these were like 10-footers. And I'd throw them straight up in the air, and they'd turn. And if I got lucky, they would hit at the right angle, and they would go boom. And it'd be like this big white poof of smoke, and I'd go, wow. So, again, but this time I got fired. Man, it was fun. Anyway, I moved to Newport Beach. I start going to a local college down there, Orange Coast College. I meet my wife-to-be working at Delaney's Restaurant. I was an oyster bar chef working behind the bar, drinking regularly. And back then, you know, I'd make $100-$150 a night, and that was a lot for 1978. You know, that's probably like $300-$400 today. And I was just having the time of my life. You know, going to Studio Cafe, drinking Adios Mothers. You know, waking up, you know, completely wet. I have a thing with showers. I don't know what it is, but you know, if I get near a shower and I was drunk, I'd be in the shower, or the shower would be on, or something. And you know, many times waking up with all my clothes in the shower, or being wet, and I don't know. It's just another one of those weird things when you're drinking. So then I got married, and we drank like crazy, had a baby, moved to San Diego because I was standing in a Radio Shack, and I saw a magazine that had an Apple IIe on the front of it in the forest. And I don't know why, but that image did something for me. It said, that's the future. Forest, computers, outdoors, working. This was like 1978, 79. I was there. So I got into microcomputers. I became a principal at a company called Quantum Systems in San Diego. I worked my ass off and taught myself everything I could about sales, about marketing, you know, because I didn't go to school for it. You know, that was self-taught. And I was able to do a good enough job where I got a piece of the company, and next thing you know, we rolled out the first airline reservation systems for PCs. It didn't exist before. So we were on CompuServe in 1985. And I was flying all over the world, meeting with executive vice presidents of the major airlines, telling them the future was going to be automated bookings, and that you're going to finally get around the travel agent. And you know, we can build the network, because we actually put these little black boxes on the airline's network that allow the PC to dial into that network and actually book travel in 1985. So we did it for American, we did it for United, we did it for Eastern, Continental, ANSET, TAA, Qantas, all the majors. We built these worldwide networks because they were the largest networks going, real-time networks before the internet. And in a way, it was their internet. And I actually got to meet Carl Icahn, who was one of the great entrepreneurs of the time and had bought on a hostile takeover TWA. And I had mentioned to him this whole vision about booking online through their network. And he said, within 10 minutes of listening to the pitch, he said, you know what? We could sell books through this. This is 1985. And he's talking about Amazon.com, basically. You know, guy was a visionary. So here I'm young, though. I'm 25 years old. We're about ready to go public. I got money. I'm flying all over the world. And I'm drinking like crazy. And am I loyal to my wife? No. No, because remember that insecurity that I had? Okay. Well, now it's like amplified. In the book, in the 12 and 12, Bill talks about, in the fourth step, he talks about basic instincts. Okay. And he says, basic instincts, these are the basic motivations for life. And they're God-given, therefore they're good. But for me as an alcoholic, I overused those basic instincts. I took them to the extremes. And when that happens, you know, I walk on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. And so I had already started this huge chain of wreckage in my life, not even realizing it. The alcohol allowed me to rationalize my behavior, okay? Rationalize, justify, and blame. So I could just continue this hedonistic lifestyle. So, you know, not only was I operating from a sense of insecurity compensated through my ego, but underneath all of it was that I didn't feel worthy. So when you don't feel worthy, how do you think you treat yourself? You don't treat yourself very well, right? Because you're not worthy. And that's that whole self-destructive behavior. Okay? I was practicing self-destructive behavior and didn't understand the underlying reasons. Okay? Now, not all of us get that insight. Okay? I got this after working the steps, working psychotherapy, and continually living this program in my sixth and seventh step. So, I had a girlfriend in New York, had a condo there, had a phone put in with one phone number so that my wife was the only one that had it, so when it rang I knew it was her. And it was called the corporate condo, and I literally lived two different lives. I was absolutely two different people. When I go to New York, I was this executive guy running amok. And when I come home, I was this family guy running amok. And I lived like that. And if that wasn't enough, I had to have a couple other girlfriends too. I mean, I was a pig at the trough. And I was hurting people. And we wound up getting divorced. I moved in with a friend of mine in La Jolla. We were going to Jose's, which is a little Mexican bar in La Jolla that was kind of our bar. And, you know, this was the time when he had limos. I mean, we would have limos every night because we had the money. I mean, you know, went to the Super Bowl in San Diego. We left at halftime because it was boring and went to the strip clubs. We just did whatever. And so we're driving to Jose's, and I see this group of people walking into the church on the top of the hill there in La Jolla. And I said, Steve, I go, what is that? And he says, well, because I thought it was like a pyramid meeting. You remember those? Where people would put in $1,000 and you'd put in $1,000 and they would go up in the pyramid and some guy would walk away with 32 grand and then the next guy, and we'd all go, so of course my thinking is, wow, it's a pyramid deal. Let's break in on this. And he's like, no, it's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They have them there at the church. And I thought, what's that? And he says, well, it's for guys that, you know, can't handle their drinking. I go, geez, what is it they can't handle? So now I'm telling you the story because I want you to understand how absolutely clueless I was at that time in my life, that I was not ready for this program at that time. Okay, and I see a lot of newcomers that come into these rooms that just are the same way. They're not there yet. You know, they haven't suffered enough or whatever it is, but they're not ready. And so I walk into this meeting, and the guy says, is there anyone here for the first time ever, Alcoholics Anonymous? And I go, yeah, me. He says, oh, come on down here and share. You know, and I was like, all right, because, you know, yeah, I'll do that. So I got up there, and I told my story. I didn't know, you know, I just told him what happened about, you know, the thing with the wife, and this was all her fault, of course, and she did this, and da-da-da-da. And I got done, and they all applauded. And I went, yeah, yes. And I went back to my friend and we high-fived each other. I said, man, you rocked the house, bro. I said, right on. See? Completely clueless, right? I rocked the house because they are applauding. So then I go, you know what? This is boring. Let's get out of here. So we split and went down to Jose's. And they would frequently cut us off here because we'd buy two drinks for everyone to the point where everybody in the whole bar was so shit-faced that they didn't want the liability. So they'd say, stop buying drinks. You just have to stop. So fast forward. I took another company public in 1999 called ecommercial.com. And this one really took off. It did very well, and I had a lot of money, and you know there were days when my stock would go up $3, 4, 5, 6, 7 million in a day. On paper, it was worth over $100 million, and I was able to get some of it out. Now, what does a good alcoholic do with that kind of money? Has some fun. So I had the Viper. I had the, you know, we bought a house, 4,100 square feet in the ocean, or up where Dan lives there, in Marblehead. Paid cash for it. Had the pink slip for it. And I was, you know, we built out this huge 15,000 square foot office up in Liso Viejo. I had the whole corner section as my own. I wanted to put a brass pole in the bar, but they said that was probably a little bit over the top. I said, okay. And it was crazy. It was absolute crazy. It was full-on debauchery, max. You know, takes my early stories and just makes them look like kids play. Well, that led to my last drunk, which I was fighting with the ex. It wasn't the ex at the time. And I was up in Marblehead, and I was shit-faced drunk, and she came at me, and I hit her on the shoulders. I just pushed, I went a step forward, hit her on the shoulders, she went off her feet, and landed on her butt. And it scared me because I didn't realize how hard I'd hit her. Because being in my current state, I felt like I just touched her, but in order to get that reaction, I must have really hit her hard. So my, at that time, 3-4 year old daughter runs in and then runs out and does 911 and then hangs up. We all know what happens when that happens. They're on their way. And I knew that. So I jumped in the Z06 and I took off. And I don't know why, but a little voice in my head said, "You're too shit-faced to drive. Pull over." That's not normal for me. But I pulled over. I knew I was too drunk. And I just threw the keys in the car and started walking. Well, I'm up here on Marblehead. And I, for some reason, in my brilliant thinking, my mind told me that if I could get to Arco Station on the Coast Highway, I'd be okay. So it had been raining for like 2 weeks straight. So that field up there that they still haven't developed yet, okay, between Arco and San Clemente, is completely muddy. And I'm in slacks, white shirt, dress shoes, whole thing. I start out walking through that. And I'm slipping and I'm sliding, but I have to get to Arco. I don't know what it is. I'm focused now. I got to get to Arco. So I go up the hill. I go down the hill. I fall. I, you know, by the time I get there, I'm a sweaty mess and I'm completely covered in mud. I mean, I'm talking head to toe. It's caked on me. I mean, it's like everywhere. So, but I made it. I made it to the Coast Highway. I'm looking at Arco and I think, oh, thank God I made it to Arco. I got to go in there and get a beer. Well, Arco doesn't sell beer. But I went in there and I got a Gatorade or something. And I was about ready to leave to call a buddy to come pick me up. And the owner or the guy working there says, "You're not going anywhere." And I said, "What do you mean I'm not going anywhere?" He says, "You're not going anywhere." Well, what happens when you tell a drunk alcoholic, you know, you're not going anywhere? Well, so I leave. He calls the police. Next thing you know, the sirens are going. I mean, I can hear them coming. I don't know what I did to this day. I have no idea. But, you know, the rocks along Coast Highway, they use as a water break. Well, it was before they had a fence up there. So my brilliant thinking says, all of a sudden I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm in that movie Predator. Okay, I'm in the movie Predator because I'm completely covered in mud, and I think, okay, I got to get to the rocks, and I got to become one with the rocks, and I will, you know, I'll get away. I'll give the cops a slip. So I run across the street and I get down into the rocks and I get in there and I get myself all, you know, like this, and I'm facing outward because that's what Arnold did. And I get in there and I just freeze. I'm completely covered in mud. Cops get there, the lights are going, the you know, they got the flashlights, they got the everything's going on, you know, and I'm like this. The lights are going across my head. They're going everywhere. Okay? After about 30 minutes or so, they leave. It worked. So, God forbid if you're ever in that situation, that works. Well, A couple of weeks prior to that experience, I was at the Renaissance, and I was shit-faced drunk, and a guy by the name of Big Jack, some of you know him, big guy, he was in there trolling for newcomers. That's what he does. He cruises around, he's got his little card, hands them out, and I knew Jack because I used to drink with him at Ragamuffins, and I knew about his accident and all the rest of it. So I saw him, and I knew he was sober, but I was freaked out because I was trying to act like I was sober. You know, I was like,
boom, I really am good. You know, I haven't been drinking much, and you know, it's all that, you know.
And he just smiled at me and handed me his card. He says, you know, give me a call sometime. That's all he said. And the next morning when I woke up with all the mud caked on me and the whole thing, I walked into the shower, and I just had that incredible, terrible fear in my belly. I don't know if you ever get that. You know, it's just complete fear. And I got in there, and the shower was going, I was taking off my clothes, and the mud was going down the drain. I was standing there, and as the mud's going down the drain, I'm looking, I'm thinking, that's it, you know. And then I have an epiphany. It says, I'm done now. I can't do this anymore. I cannot live like this anymore. And that was the last time I drank. So, you know, that was this very powerful experience for me. It was this aha moment. And I went to breakfast, and guess who was sitting there? Big Jack. And I just knew that was a sign from God. Because in the shower, I'd asked God for help. And I go to breakfast, like, you know, 15 minutes later, and there's Jack. And I just said, that's it. So I checked into, I tried to get a Betty Ford, but they were full, so they sent me over to the hospital up there in Orange, St. Joseph's, thank you. And these guys know my story better than I do. That's where I met my beautiful wife, Diane. And they don't recommend that, by the way. But 11 years later, here we are. And we're madly in love, and she's wonderful. And that started my program in Alcoholics Anonymous. So let's get into a little bit of recovery. At first, I knew nothing. I was scared to death. I went to my first meeting at the Friendship Center. I went in there. I sat down. It was kind of a forced chair because it was what's good about today, and I just started crying and asking for help. All the men in the program came at the break, and they handed me their cards. Buzz gave me a book, a little 12 and 12, and he wrote it and says, you know, keep coming back, and I still have that today. So I was just amazed at the outpouring and the support. I got a sponsor, Randy G. At the time, I just liked what he had. I had no idea of his history. We couldn't be more different. Okay, here's a guy that spent 20 years in the penitentiary, and I'd never seen inside a jail cell. But you know what we had in common? We were both alcoholics. And he's loved me unconditionally all these years and through a lot of stuff. I took the steps the first time. I had to do it twice because I didn't do it right the first time. Because I just wrote a book on my four step. And Randy just listened to it, said that was really interesting. But you know what? Let's do the columns, and you know, we'll talk about what you're part in it, and so forth. And I got to tell you that the first step for me is, you know, it's what you learn out there. You know, really, the first step is out there. The second step is this came to believe, and for me, you know, initially came to believe. I thought I had to have faith before I could continue with the steps. But that's not what it is at all. It just means that I have to have willingness to believe. Okay. And how I get willingness is I get willingness by sitting in rooms like this and hearing the speakers, or listening to the people who take birthdays share about how they did it, or I read in the book and I read the stories about those people, how they did it, and I listen to a sponsor who tells me how he did it, and eventually I hear enough people who've had enough success that, you know, I say, okay, I'm willing to give this thing a shot. I'm willing to give this thing a gamble. I'm willing to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Ah, why am I insane? Well, it tells me in the doctor's opinion why I'm insane, right? Because I've got a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, and if I take that first drink, I'm gone, right? And the insanity part is that my mind tells me that I can take the first drink and not suffer, not have any problems. Okay, that's the insanity of it. So all of a sudden, I'm mentally and physically different than my fellows. Why? Because I have this little slice of insanity when it comes to alcohol. Am I insane in all the other things in my life? Not necessarily. Am I insane when I'm drunk and drinking and doing stupid stuff? Of course, I'm intoxicated. But when I'm not drinking, and my mind says that I'm not an alcoholic or I can drink, that's insane. Because guess what happens? I take the drink, I'm off and running. Okay? So, the step two says, came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Okay? That's what separates me from all the other normies in the world. They don't have that insidious insanity. Okay. So, but the book always also says that I have to find a higher power. It's the only thing. The higher power is the only thing that's going to relieve me of that insanity. It's really not an option. It took me a while to really fully get my head around that. Okay. So then I go to step three, and it says, now I made a decision. Okay. Well, I became willing. It doesn't mean I have to have faith. See, faith is something different than belief. Right? Faith comes after belief. Right? I have to believe something first. I got to try it. I have to experience it. Once I experience it, then I can have faith in it. Right? Okay. So that whole thing on step two is not about faith. It's about belief. It's a big difference. So then I go to step three. I make a decision because now, you know, I'm ready to do it. Okay. So I have to decide. Okay. I'm going to do it. But then I got to do it. So what do? I start by taking that third step prayer. Now, does the third step prayer give me the spiritual awakening that I need, right, to free me from what? The insanity. Right? That's the reason. That's the whole purpose here. Free me from the insanity. Does saying the third step prayer do it? No. Because the book says that sanity returns when? After the ninth step. Right? In the promises. Sanity will return. Okay? So that means I gotta go vigorous action after I do my third step prayer. And by the way, I love that prayer. I love the promises in that prayer, and one of them is freedom of the bondage of self, which is that ego, which is that persona that I can now let go of. Holy smokes. And let the real me out. Wow. That's scary shit. But I can do it with the fellowship. See? The combination of the fellowship along with sponsorship, along with, you know, my perseverance, I'm safe now, and I can allow that process to happen. Right? That's the transformative power of this program. This is called character building. And unfortunately for us, it's a lifelong deal. Because if we don't continually evolve and build our characters, guess what? My head tells me that I can drink again. And I float right back into that insanity. So I got to go vigorous action. I got to start the fourth step. I got to share it. I got to see my part in it. Now, what's the benefit of that? Well, the benefit for me was that I had a lot of guilt, shame, remorse, angst, anger, resentments that I got to get off my chest. And for the first time ever, I got to be completely honest with another human being. Holy smokes. I'm a constant liar. I'm a liar, 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 liar because of what? That insecurity compensated by my ego, right? So now I can let go of all that. Holy shit. How freeing is that? Wow. I don't have to play that game anymore. All right? So I do my fifth step. So the fifth step has a couple of things for me. One, it's unloading all this garbage. Two, I'm being able to be honest totally with another human being. Okay? Three, I get to discover character defects. I never thought I had character defects. I didn't know what those were. Okay? But when I started seeing my part in things, I could start to see when I was selfish. I could start to see when I was, you know, lying. And I could start to see all those people that I had hurt because of my behavior, which stemmed from my thinking, okay, which was all about me. You know, selfishness is the root of our problems, okay? All right, so then I get into 6 and 7, and I pray to God, I become willing, and I say, God, please take these character defects after I've identified them. Now, is it stopped there? No, not for me. Because God will do for me what I can't do myself, but God will not do for me what I can do for myself. Right? So that means that I have to take 6 and 7, and I have to live 6 and 7 every day. I have to become vigilant. See, if I'm not vigilant, then I'm not growing. If I do the steps, I'm in trouble. I can't do the steps and just say, okay, I've done the steps. It doesn't work that way. I have to live the steps. I have to integrate them into my life every day, every minute of every day. It sounds like a tall order. You know, can't go through with it. But you take little steps. And it just gets better and better and better. Okay, so I'm always trying to say, am I in love or am I in fear? Okay. And try to figure out if I'm in fear, okay, if I'm rationalizing, justifying, blaming, Okay, I better do something about it. Okay, I got to stop and ask myself, where am I? Why am I doing this? What's going on? What's my motivations? What are my intentions? Okay, I have to question those things. Step 8, I made a list. I already made the list. I got the list. Okay. Step 9, go make amends. Scary stuff. My sponsor told me, he says, why don't you make 3 lists? One of everybody that you want to make amends to right now, one that you want to do later, one that you want to do like really later, and some you don't want to do at all. You're just never going to do it. That was cool because it gave me an out. Because there was that one that I'm never going to do that was, you know, pretty lengthy at one time. But after I did the first ones that I was going to do, I felt pretty good about it, even though it was scary. And then the ones that I was going to do a little bit later, I did. And then the ones after that, by the time I got to the, you know, the 4th list, it wasn't as bad. I still make amends today. People come into my life that I had either forgotten about or hadn't seen in a long time. Boom, I think, oh, shit, I think I'll make amends. I always get a little bit nervous, like, oh, in my head, you know, because I'm fear, right? But I have realized through the awakening of the Spirit, and I'm going to wrap it up, through the awakening of the Spirit, that I am not my thoughts, I am not my emotions, and that the sunlight of the Spirit is my true nature. And that's what I need to identify with. If I identify with my true nature of the sunlight of the Spirit, then I'm free. I'm free of the bondage of self. And to me, that's the end game for this program. Because that gives me, as we heard right from the start, it gives me love for you. It allows me to do service for you. And it gives me peace and serenity. That's the power of this program. God bless. Thank you.